Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. We're so excited to have you join us this week. We've got a great lineup of topics. We're going to talk about, Ernest, what are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about earnings from a few of our companies.
Yeah.
As well as Netflix potentially acquiring Warner.
Awesome. And stay tuned, of course. Next week, we plan to review the Canadian bank earnings as well. So lots to cover. We want to talk about a special webinar that we'll be having on December 11th at 7 p.m. We will be discussing our investment strategy, what worked in 2025, what we're looking forward to in 2026, as well as our thoughts on the current market. Ernest, you've been busy prepping the presentation. Any teasers, anything that people would learn from the webinar that we're going to do on December 11th at 7 p.m.?
I think anybody who has followed us and our investing philosophy for enough time would, you know, kind of know already what types of companies that we like to look for, what our general investment philosophy is like. But hopefully, we'll share a little bit more details about the current environment in terms of, you know, how we're thinking about things like AI and whether compounding as a strategy still makes sense.
Sounds great. So once again, presentation will be on December 11th at 7 p.m. We will include a Zoom link in this podcast. You can sign up for it. We'll also post and remind you on all socials. And I think it'll be a good time. If you miss the presentation, of course, it will be recorded and it will be up on YouTube as well as our website. And we look forward also to taking your questions in the Zoom link. We'll give you instructions as to how to send your questions. So presentation will be by me and Ernest and our partner, Benjamin Klein. And we really look forward to doing that very shortly. Before we get to all the wonderful topics we're going to talk about today, we want to remind you that please subscribe to this podcast on all socials, Apple and YouTube and Spotify. You can catch us audio only, video only, or a combination.
Video only.
maybe some people just don't want to hear us, but see the, what is that? Listen to closed caption. God only knows. And of course, please check out BaskinWealthManagement.com. We're very proud of our brand new website, very transparent in how we deal with clients. We're one of the few firms out there that manages portfolios on a separate basis. That means each client has a separately managed portfolio. Our minimum is $1 million per family relationship. And it's a lot of hard work for us, but it's what we think is best for the clients. We really love it. And if you ever have any questions about your portfolio, please feel free to reach out to your portfolio managers. And if you want to have a meeting with me or Ernest and talk about the potential of becoming a client, we're very happy to meet with you. So, Ernest, coming to the end of November, we wish all our American friends a happy Thanksgiving. I see that it's snowing outside. There's football on TV. The Canadian market's open. I don't know why the Canadian market is open on Thanksgiving, U.S. Thanksgiving, because there's...
Why would it not be?
Well, there's not a lot of liquidity. There's like 5 shares of everything traded.
Yeah, I think there was somebody had observed that Constellation Software stock, and it's one of the larger companies in Canada, it was barely even trading today.
Yeah, so it goes to show you how important the Canadian stock market is to the rest of the globe. That being said, the Canadian stock market, all-time highs again. Boy, oh boy, the right sectors seem to be working for Canada. Gold, uranium, you know, even oil stocks are starting to tick up, natural gas prices. Canada has a little bit of exposure, of course, to some AI through Shopify and Celestica. The Canadian financials are working. It's been a strong, strong year for the Toronto. To me, it's kind of catch up to really the underperformance that the TSX has had over the last number of years. You know, it just There's no Magnificent Seven in the TSX, and that's obviously what has driven just the indices in the U.S. to record levels. But this is the year where the Canadian market caught up, even though it's dominated by the banks and the financials and the utilities and the pipelines. The gold stocks out of nowhere have gone tremendous. Unfortunately, we don't own any of the gold stocks. And, we've done podcasts in the past discussing why we stick with companies that we think will be able to benefit over the long term. In my opinion, gold is a hedge against inflation, a hedge against printing money. Well, I think there's other great hedges as well, and that's owning companies that have pricing power, the ability to reinvest their cash flows at high rates of return, and terrific business models that can really be able to sell your products globally. Whereas gold, in our opinion, it's a very tough business to be in, the gold mining business. Certainly the economics of it are not that attractive to us. But no question, with the gold price going up a lot, sure, gold companies are cashing in.
Yeah, I think there is a disconnect between the TSX performance and I think certainly the economic fundamentals that you're seeing within Canada, mm-hmm. which is fairly sluggish economy overall. The GDP is not growing, especially certainly not on a per capita basis.
That's right.
Productivity is fairly weak, But then the sectors that are performing well, as you noted, are materials, which including gold, the financials, which are, I think we'll talk more about this next week, but a large portion of the banker earnings are increasingly coming from like investment banking and wealth management, which are, they're going to benefit when the stock market is doing well.
That's right.
So I think that it's less of a reflection of and if you look at companies like, say, CN Rail, right, or even the Canadian telcos, they reflect an economy where consumers are not necessarily in the best place.
Yeah, it's a very interesting economy, and I think you hit the nail on the head. The financials obviously benefiting from interest rates coming down, benefiting from strong markets, commodities betting. Well, I mean, gold. This is the year where the gold bugs won out, where their doom and gloom scenarios seem to have worked and picked up the gold stocks. But we have to give credit where credit is due to a lot of the Canadian companies. Everybody expected that we would be heading into a downturn because of the tariffs. There's a lot of companies that righted the ship, so to speak, improved their balance sheets, worked around these tariff issues. And I think the lesson here is a lot of our clients focus a lot on Main Street, but the Bay Street and Wall Street, the makeup of the indices is not what you see when you walk down the street and a restaurant is closing or someone loses a job and you get all worried about that. When you invest in the stock market, especially the high quality companies, these are the best businesses in the world, right?
Right.
And so they have the ability to be a lot more nimble when the economy falters, so to speak.
Right.
So we have a few more earnings that we want to finish off for Q3. Ernest, why don't you kick it off? I think the first one we want to talk about is
Alimentation Couche-Tard.
Very nice. So finally, Couche-Tard. We talked about it on the last podcast we did about Couche-Tard. Our hope was that it would turn the tide in terms of same-store sales growth. I think we've now seen two or three quarters in a row of improvement. And if that continues, Couche-Tard is back to printing organic growth numbers. The company's balance sheet is in great shape. It started to buy back a significant amount of stock. We'll get into that. And although it still faces challenges across many of its different geographies, the United States, Canada, and Europe, it looks like things are starting to clear and the picture is starting to get more robust for Couche-Tard and its shareholders going forward. So Ernest, you know a lot about convenience stores.
Yep. So I think the big picture for this company has always been that the convenience store sector is a good place to be overall, mm-hmm. as because they're very convenient. They're generally located in the best places around town, mm-hmm. and that people are going to increasingly visit these places to, both by cigarettes and drinks, but increasingly fresh food and especially meals.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, sometimes a convenience store is the only game in town, so to speak,
yep.
if you're talking about some rural areas in North America, especially with Canada and the U.S. being gigantic places. You know, the local convenience store, gas station in a small town may do gangbuster businesses selling the perishable food you want, but certainly a good amount of takeaway food.
And so the Couche-Tard has gone through quite a bit over the last since COVID. Mm-hmm. So first there was all the shutdowns due to COVID and convenience stores being deemed as an essential retailer. Mm-hmm. So they had a surge of traffic from that for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they're still kind of facing the headwinds as a result of society reopening. Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing. And the second thing that they've gone through is that they went through a long, expensive campaign to try and buy 7-Eleven, which ultimately did not occur, yeah. right? So we're now past all of this. Traffic had been weak for a while. People are just not visiting convenience stores to the same degree that they used to. Mm-hmm. And people are wondering, or the market is wondering, whether the story for Couche-Tard and the whole strategy where they continue to make acquisitions continues to make sense. Mm-hmm. And so this quarter, it's the second quarter in a row where they reported positive same-store sales in the U.S., mm-hmm. which is their largest region.
They were showing positive same-store sales in Europe and Canada.
Yes.
Not each and every quarter for the
right.
last nine quarters, so to speak.
Right.
But this is the first two quarters in a row of positive same-store sales
in the U.S.
growth in the U.S.
In the U.S. And it was specifically attributed to their efforts that they've made in food. Mm-hmm. So they've launched these meal deals and signed a few partnerships with some celebrity chefs mm-hmm. where they want to make the food a little bit better so that, you know, as an incremental source of revenues for their convenience stores.
So this is hot food, like breakfast sandwiches,
yeah.
hot dogs, hamburgers, pizza slices.
Yeah.
You know, nothing fancy, nothing extraordinary, like maybe some of the other convenience stores that are higher end in the United States, but definitely up their game.
Yeah, and I think there is certainly, especially in Canada and the United States, at least even for myself, there is a perception issue with convenience store food being, you know, not necessarily very high quality options that
yeah.
exist.
Yeah, it's for, you know, your late nights or when you're a little kid and you bike to the convenience store
yeah.
or you have a long road trip and you're hungry or nothing else is open. You know, that's why convenience stores exist.
Yep.
Yep.
But then it seems like they're starting to gain a little bit of traction mm-hmm. In launching these meal deals. They acquired a company called GetGo, which just closed about a couple months ago, that is a standalone concept where they are a bit more specialized in food. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how they are able to implement that within their network. And then I think beyond that, they still remain on the hunt for acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
I think it still remains a very fragmented landscape for convenience stores in the U.S., where about half of the stores remain owned by individual operators or small chains.
Mm-hmm.
I think this quarter they bought 8 stores from Texaco. Mm-hmm. It's Texaco branded stores. So really kind of just plugging along and gaining share kind of store by store, but looking for large deals to the extent that they could be found.
And Couche-Tard can make these large deals because it generates ample free cash flow, right?
It's, yep.
There's nothing else it wants to do with the cash flow now, but recognizing the stock price has fallen a lot and now that the earnings have recovered, probably the best place in the short term was buying back its own shares,
yep.
unless there's a great deal. The company also raises dividend again, 10%. The yield, you're not buying this for the dividend, but the dividend growth has been spectacular. I think it is a dividend aristocrat, right? It's raises dividend many, many years in a row.
Possibly.
Well, don't take that as fact, but it certainly has a nice track record of increasing returns to shareholders.
Shows you how much I care about the dividend.
Yeah. Well, it's a 1.2% dividend
right.
yield. And, you know, in an environment where interest rates are coming down, I think you want to gravitate towards companies that return cash to shareholders in a tax efficient and smart way. Certainly, Couche-Tard.
No, but I think the point that you made was an important one. On the buybacks, because I think for a lot of quality Canadian compounders, so companies that kind of built their business on acquisitions, these companies, like, they've been relatively out of favor compared to gold and compared to AI-related tech stocks, where today, if you look at the prices and the multiples that the market is valuing them at, there is not a lot of premium assigned to the potential for capital allocation. Mm-hmm. So the potential to do mergers and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. So for a company like Couche-Tard, where it was trading at about 16 times earnings, generating a lot of free cash flow, even if they don't, and business remains fairly resilient, like there's not really any secular challenges facing the convenience store business, even if they are no longer able to do deals and are just spending all of their cash flow into repurchases, I think you still end up with a pretty good outcome with these stocks. And not just Couche-Tard, but a lot of the other names that we follow, I think that's true as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, the math makes a lot of sense, right? If you're buying back 3 to 4% of your stock a year, you're paying out a 1 to 2% dividend, you're able to improve margins as you grow. I mean, Couche-Tard's still adding more stores, right? They're building stores on spec, so to speak, right? They're able to improve margins. They're able to benefit from same-store sales growth. Inflation is always present. So, you know, Couche-Tard doesn't have control over the prices of everything it's in its stores, right? If Coca-Cola says you have to raise the price of Coca-Cola, you know, Couche-Tard follows along with that model, right? So there's some benefit from inflation there. And you could see that over a number of years, if they're able to buy back their stock at a cheap valuation, you could be set up for a very nice, strong return. Those that follow Couche-Tard have to recognize that Couche, even though it's very weird, trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange. It actually reports all its fundamentals in U.S. dollars.
Yep.
So when Ernest talks about it's trading at 16 times earnings, it's trading at 16 times its earnings based on adjusted to Canadian dollars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And they have talked about the potential of doing a deal up to $10 billion on their balance sheet without having to issue equity, which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
So, I don't see any reason to think that their acquisition model won't continue going forward.
Yeah.
Especially as we are in an environment where fuel volumes are a little bit more, seems to be more secularly challenged as consumers are driving more hybrids, certainly, and may be motivated to sell to consolidators like Couche-Tard.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised one day Couche-Tard issues a U.S. listing. I wouldn't be surprised that comes with a large acquisition. Yep. I wouldn't be surprised for Couche-Tard to rebrand its name as Circle K.
Right.
Maybe
tough given the Quebec
thing. But I think that would reduce the complication of the story slightly. These are all dreams that I have. But when I look at the next few years for Couche-Tard, I'm excited about the inflection of turning the corner on same-store sales growth. I'm excited about really the world is its oyster. Either it buys back stock if it doesn't get any respect for its stock valuation, or it can go out and make acquisitions. I think they have a pretty good track record of making acquisitions and delivering on synergies. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. No, and that's really the key to the M&A strategy, which is that when they do a deal, it's usually it's either an independent, which is a smaller company that is kind of geographically contained in an area, or an acquisition from a integrated oil major who used to run an integrated service from extraction to refinery to owning the retail stores.
Yeah.
So they did one in Europe from Total Energies, for instance. Mm-hmm. So for both of these options, they usually can generate a lot of synergies by plugging it into their fuel network, upgrading the convenience stores and improving the quality of the food and the offer that they have there, as well as from a supplier perspective, where now because they have more stores, they're able to leverage, they're able to negotiate better supply arrangements as well.
Yeah. And from what we've read, I think Couche-Tard on a global basis only has a 6% market share of convenience stores, something like that, a very small number. Doesn't mean they're going to get up to 50% in our lifetime, but clearly the goal is they don't think there's anything wrong with the business model. And we just have to let time and the economy start to recover in its favor, which clearly looks like it's happening. Was there anything that Couche-Tard called out that really improved aside from the food offering? Yeah. Was it what changed? Because we saw some comps in some of the U.S. states as high as 5% improvement year over year.
Yeah, so they said that there is a difference in results across different regions in the U.S. where the southern regions, so Arizona and Texas and Florida, are a little bit weaker, possibly due to less snowbirds traveling down to the U.S. as well as impact from maybe immigration-related issues down there.
Makes sense. Yeah.
While in the northern regions, where they have, I think, really focused more on launching fresh and hot food, they are seeing a better comp uplift in those places.
Mm-hmm. Any plans for them to continue to roll out more fresh and hot food across all their locations? I see in Canada, some of the Circle K locations do have fresh food. Some of them don't. It really depends on, I guess it's regional too, right?
Yeah.
Depending on regional tastes. In Quebec, you may go and there's more pastries and cookies and that kind of thing. Whereas, in the U.S., maybe there'll be more, types of breakfast sandwiches and hot dogs and hamburgers.
I think it'll be hard. Yeah. So they've been very selective about how they are rolling out food because this has literally been a decade plus long journey for them to try and sell more food within stores. Yeah. But the challenge is that for most of their stores, they're just not set up and equipped with a full kitchen to be able to prepare quality food. Mm-hmm. So
it's more grab and go stuff.
Right. And it's the same kind of challenge that we've seen with Starbucks trying to sell, expand from coffee into high quality prepared food. You just can't do that if you are, shipping food prepared in a factory over to there to be reheated.
That's fair.
There's only so much you can do to make the food taste
good. But Couche-Tard doesn't have to be everything to everybody. It doesn't have to be a high-end convenience store. It knows its place, and I think adding incremental improvements and stepping up its game will certainly prove out in the results.
No, and I think it will have to be a regional. Mm-hmm. This is a business that is won on a regional basis, where just because something worked in Canada or Ontario doesn't mean it's going to work in Florida.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't mean it's going to work in Europe.
So,
right.
Yeah. And Couche-Tard has tried to purchase competitors in the past who do have maybe, I'm not sure if 7-Eleven has better hot food offerings.
In Japan, they certainly do.
In Japan, but in the United States, it's pretty gross, those taquitos anyways. But they tried to acquire Casey's, for example. And Casey's is now one of the largest pizza chains in the U.S. I think it's fifth biggest pizza chain, right? So, that could have worked out for him. Anyways, Couche-Tard, I think there's nothing broken here. We're excited to see the company more on a stable footing. And I think the smart place for Couche-Tard's capital allocation right now is, absent a great acquisition, just keep buying back that stock. The valuation for a very recession-resilient business, given that it's inflecting higher, seems quite attractive to us.
Yep.
Very good. Any other companies we want to talk about?
So let's stick on the theme of cars.
Okay.
Talk about Copart.
Okay.
And it seems like for a lot of our listeners to this podcast are very interested in our views on Copart.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody's interested in your views when the stock stinks, right?
Yes.
And Copart's stock has stunk this year. Prior to 2025, pretty much a linear move in its stock. Strong results from its auto auction business, distracted drivers, causing more accidents because it's so expensive to fix cars. The more of them are going to junk. And Copart moved into auctions into heavy equipment as well, like moving more into Europe. The thesis made a lot of sense, but it has hit a wall recently, and Ernest will explain why.
Yeah, so the big narrative is that they are losing share to IAA, which is owned by Ritchie Brothers.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at the volumes, the number of cars that are sold by these companies, I think it certainly matches that case, where for last few quarters, IAA has been selling more and more cars, while Copart has been selling less and less cars. So people are saying, well, given the fact that historically Copart has gained market share from IAA, now under new ownership, maybe it's time for IAA to regain some of its
And that's
market
fair.
Share.
And yep. IAA has had a troubled past. It was owned by private equity. It was public, yep. Standalone. Never had enough scale, never had enough ability to do what Copart was doing. Copart focused more on owning and the yep. land, which it thought would give it a competitive advantage. I assume that under new ownership, where they don't have to break out the results as much, it's clear that Copart's maybe being undercutted in terms of price. It's
no,
potential.
I think there's there's a lot going on beneath the hood.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, number
good,
one
good
is
pun there.
So yeah. Number one is that IAA's main customer, largest customer, is Progressive Insurance, which is I think the second largest insurer in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And Progressive has been outperforming the other insurers.
Why is that?
I think I'm not a super, I don't follow these companies super closely, but I think they've made a lot of investments into analytics to price insurance more profitably and smarter than other companies.
Okay, so they've taken a lot of market share writing car insurance.
From Allstate and Geico
and
State Farm, yeah.
And IAA is a main customer.
Yeah.
So why doesn't Copart work with Progressive?
Well, so these are usually long-term arrangements that are signed with the insurance company and the auction player. So if your customers are doing, if IAA's customers are doing better, then they're going to do better than Copart. If Copart,
yeah, we understand. Yeah.
So I think that if you kind of look beyond that, what Copart has insisted is that they are not losing direct market share among their own customer base. It is entirely a mix shift where Progressive is, insuring more cars and versus State Farm and Allstate and Geico. And so that's one reason why IAA has been outperforming.
So the number of cars being sold at auction isn't going down.
It is.
Globally?
It is. It is.
Yeah, why?
No, so that's the
I'm talking about overall.
No, they are. So that was the customer aspect is the first part.
Okay, so the customer, Copart just doesn't have the customer that's growing the fastest at the moment.
And, whether the other insurers catch up to Progressive at some point, who knows?
Well, insurance is a commodity business, right? Yeah. So at the end of the day, as a customer buying car insurance, I just want to pay the lowest price.
Yeah.
Right? I don't care if it's with Progressive Insurance or Ernest Insurance. As long as you provide me with good customer service and I can get my money when I crash my car, I'm happy with you, right? And so clearly Progressive's done something right, but clearly the other insurers will try and grab back that market share, I would assume.
Yep, so that's the first thing.
People sign car insurance deals for 1 year, right? When you sign up your car insurance as a customer, you sign for 1 year.
I think it varies, depends on the insurer.
Okay.
But the second thing is that people are getting less insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, not getting car insurance at all.
Then that's because of the high price of insurance.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because in 2022, when inflation was going up, I think a lot of the insurance companies raised premiums.
Mm-hmm.
And you add to the fact that the consumer is a little bit more challenged today. Yeah. And so what a lot of people are doing is, in many cases, they're getting less insurance, so not covering collisions, for instance, or they're dropping in car insurance altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And so the effect of this is that there are less insurance claims and therefore less cars being sent to salvage auctions.
And this is affecting the entire industry.
Yes.
Not just Copart.
Yeah.
Specifically.
And so I think this is the bigger factor for the underperformance of Copart, because if you look at the industry level of claims and the reporting from companies like Geico, it's very, very close to what Copart is reporting in terms of their weak volumes as well. So I think the kind of the natural question beyond that is, well, if people aren't claiming when they get into an accident, then where are the cars going?
Yeah.
Right? And so this is the interesting part, which I think is really what explains the volume gap between IAA and Copart, which is that people are still getting into accidents.
Yeah.
But what's happening is that they are not filing insurance claims on these cars. So instead, so what they're doing is they're either just driving around a broken car, which I think certainly you see some of that around when you're driving.
Yep, for sure.
Or they are salvaging them themselves through programs like, you know, there's charities like Cash for Cars.
1-800-1877-CARS-FOR-KIDS?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So there's those types of programs, which are usually lower value cars. These are lower quality vehicles that don't sell for as high price. Copart, about 3-4 years ago, had deprioritized these cars. They don't want them because they're lower value, forcing IAA to really pick up the slack.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really where you're seeing the gap in volumes from Copart to IAA. And it's reflected in the fact that this quarter, average selling prices for Copart cars were up, I think, 7% and up 2% for IAA. Because they're picking up all these value cars that are otherwise not going to Copart.
Got it. Interesting.
So I think that's a story that is not really very well understood about what's happening between these two players.
And that's why you're seeing still Copart's earnings grow.
Yes.
Right? So this is not a story where Copart is a melting ice cube. It's doing the best it can on salvaging the cars and getting higher margins on it.
Right.
However, the volume is mixed. So what changes here? We know in Canada, of course, you can't drive a vehicle without insurance.
Right.
In the United States, obviously, that's a different situation. I don't know if it's state to state.
Yes.
Yeah. So that will probably never change, forced insurance on drivers in the United States.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a bit of a question about whether people will ultimately resume getting more insurance as rates start to come down.
That's right.
Because insurance companies are currently making a lot of money.
So what is the outlook for insurance rates coming down?
I think Copart would certainly hope that they start to come down because that means that they're going to lead to more companies going back to Copart.
So these are things that Copart cannot control.
Right.
What it can control right now is its capital allocation. And many have been in awe at Copart's balance sheet, which now has, I think, over 10% of its market value in cash.
$5 billion.
$5 billion. It's been investing that in, it's not doing anything. Well, it's doing something with it. It's putting that into treasury bills and, you know, it's no joke to invest $5 billion at 4 or 5%. Yep. That's pretty decent interest. But Copart has been reluctant to buy back its stock or make a meaningful acquisition in the last few years. So this cash balance continues to grow. Also, Copart was heavy in investing in land, right? Buying junkyards. It seems that for now, those expenses have kind of stabilized, right? They've acquired all they want to acquire.
Yep.
So what's the next step for this gigantic $5 billion of cash and growing?
Yeah, I think at some point you will probably see a large share buyback.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know when that will happen.
Yeah, no.
I think they've always been on the hunt for acquisitions as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've done a deal in the heavy equipment space. They've done one for things like ATVs and boats and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So I think whatever happens will probably be a good outcome for shareholders.
In the meantime, Copart is vindicated on its growth in Europe.
Yes.
Right? Outside North America, strong results there.
Right. And again, that's really about building up the network of auctions where they can go in there, convince the insurance companies to adopt the same type of auction model that they have in the United States and plug it into their global buyer base from emerging markets.
So what do you do with the stock here, right? It's clear that there are some major headwinds for Copart. You have to decide if those headwinds are structural or cyclical or it's just timing. We don't think the... And you'll get to it in a minute. We don't think the business model of junking cars is at all broken. In fact, it's probably going to become a better business going forward because?
Well, I think part of it is just because car prices are going up.
Yeah.
They're getting more complex because of the dynamics that we described with Couche-Tard, where people are buying more hybrids. They're buying more complex cars that have more sensors, which are more costly to repair. And so I think insurance companies still want to send more cars to auction because it makes more sense. And especially so because Copart is able to make more money for them when they're auctioning the car versus fixing it at like a garage.
Correct. And Copart uses a statistics where it thinks over the next few years, the number of cars that are deemed total loss will increase significantly.
Yes.
Right. So I think what is the number right now? About 20%?
It is a little higher than that. Okay. Like 22, 23-ish.
Yeah. And Copart sees a path to almost 30%.
Yep.
And that's because of the things you just listed, the higher prices for cars, the struggle to fix cars when they get into accidents. Obviously, a long-term person will say, well, what happens when we're all in automated cars and robo-taxis? I mean, that could be the future. It seems it's very far away, and cars still would need to be insured.
No, and I think in that situation, it's not entirely clear what happens to the insurance industry or a company like Copart, because these autonomous cars still need to be managed by fleets. They still need to be managed when they reach the end of their life, because the utilization of these autonomous vehicles is probably going to go much higher. And I think that the total loss rate in that case would be extremely high, because there is just no, the repair market is going to collapse in the absence of the need to do that.
Yep.
So I think it's an open question as to whether Copart actually ends up being hurt by that, in that outcome.
Yeah. So in the meantime, we're not going to sell the stock.
Nope.
And the earnings are still growing. And good things can happen. Bad things happen. Good things can happen. This is a company that's been through a number of issues over the long term. It has a great track record of buying back shares. If they do announce a large share buyback, I think that'll be a strong catalyst for the company and for shareholders. And we still like the economics of the business as well as the potential tailwinds. And I think a lot of these issues will be figured out. So attractive time, in our opinion, for investors who understand that there could be a couple more quarters of not such hot results. But I think now that's well understood by the market as well.
And it's still a very cash flow generative business, especially with the fact that they don't really have a lot of needs for reinvestment because they already own all their land. So when you have cash flow and when your business, that gives you the ability to manage through difficult times.
Okay, let's pivot quickly to talk about Netflix, because the stock is under pressure. It's in the news because it's bidding for Warner Brothers Discovery. Warner Brothers Discovery is a merger of Warner Brothers and Discovery. It owns cable networks. It owns HBO, HBO Max, a lot of IP, makes movies, TV shows, sells them, as well as a streaming business. Netflix is not at all interested in owning cable networks.
No.
It doesn't want to own the Home and Garden TV channel, but it is interested in the intellectual property that HBO has, right? HBO has some amazing shows, Game of Thrones. You may have seen The Penguin, for example. I'm watching, have you heard of the show called The Pitt?
No.
Okay, so it's a medical show. It's a lot of fun. I mean, there's some really great content. And quite frankly, some of its content is much higher quality than some of the Netflix slop. But the bottom line is the market is worried, A, Netflix will overpay. B, that Netflix will issue a lot of stock to get it done because it doesn't have the cash. Or that it will, it will just put the stock under pressure for a while. And obviously there's regulatory concerns because if Netflix acquires HBO, it really has all the best IP locked up pretty much aside from Star Wars and Marvel.
Yeah. So there's currently three companies that are reportedly interested in buying Warner. Mm-hmm. They would be Netflix, Paramount with David Ellison, and Comcast. And based on the reporting, like obviously we don't have any inside or even close to inside information about this, what's the discussions, but Comcast and Netflix are interested in purchasing only the movie studio and the streaming business, mm-hmm. while Paramount is interested in purchasing everything.
Yeah.
And Warner had been, they've been preparing kind of for this moment where even before this bidding war occurred, there had been a planned split of the cable networks and the studio businesses already.
Got it.
So
the cable business is a melting ice cube, but spins off a lot of free cash flow.
Right. So that would be like CNN and TNT and
Home and Garden, whatever.
Home and Garden,
all the Discovery shows,
HBO,
Animal
Channel,
Planets. Yeah. Yeah.
And that is the cash cow business, mm-hmm. but the IP is owned by the studios, which is what Netflix wants. And I think before we get into the economics of it, I think it's pretty obvious why Netflix wants mm-hmm. Warner Brothers, because they have Game of Thrones, they have Harry Potter, they have Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And these are just great IP that people want to watch.
So let's break it down for those. So in Canada, for example, you can't subscribe to HBO Max, but you can subscribe to Crave.
Yes.
Which licenses HBO and Warner Brothers IP. And I pay a monthly amount to Crave,
yes.
as well as Netflix. If Netflix merges or buys Warner Brothers, I ain't going to pay for Crave anymore.
No, so I think I think that has been the challenge for Warner Brothers in expanding internationally because so much of their business has been tied up in agreements with companies like Bell. They have an agreement with Sky in the UK where they're contractually obligated to provide the content that they're making to these distribution partners mm-hmm. with not avoid competing directly against them by launching their own streaming service, which is why if you look at the amount of money that they're making internationally, I think they earn something like $3 a subscriber mm-hmm. versus Netflix, which is over $10.
Got it.
So it's been very, very challenging for Warner Brothers to, even before considering the fact that Netflix is a larger company and has a stronger business model, there are all these challenges that have prevented Warner from even being able to launch a competitive streaming service.
Okay, so let's say that the regulators approve it. It seems pretty doubtful, but let's say the regulators approve it. Netflix buys HBO. They shut down the HBO streaming service.
Okay,
just playing it out here. They lose the revenues from the monthly subscription, but I assume Netflix would then just raise prices.
Yeah, so I think that, again, like we're just spitballing.
It's conversation.
Because there's been no agreement reached mm-hmm. between Netflix and Warner. There's still, the process is still, the bidders are still out there.
Mm-hmm. But where we are right now is they've asked for bids. And then they asked for sweetened bids by December 1st. So we won't know anything until later next week.
Right. Mm-hmm. But Warner's business model today is largely still legacy distribution. So what I mean by that is that when like make new Batman, for instance, that they first show it in a theater, they earn the box office, then they license that movie to cable TV, cable networks, or
pay-per-view,
yep. And maybe HBO Max,
yep.
And even sometimes Netflix, where yep. Netflix currently already licenses some of HBO's shows. I think Netflix's motivation here is obviously to get away from all of that to bring the content onto Netflix for their own benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Because why would they do that otherwise, right? Now, I think the
Netflix will obviously remain committed to the movies
yes.
that we're making, but they won't say forever.
No, and I yeah. think that's been something that has been reported where Netflix said they were willing to keep the existing agreements with theaters, mm-hmm. so kind of preserve the exclusive window that some of its movies will have when they go to the theater.
For sure. Because there's still big money to be made by showing the next Batman movie, or I'm blanking on some Warner Brothers IP. Is there going to be, like, Harry Potter, for yeah. example? If there's a new Harry Potter, you'd be stupid not to show...
Or that dragon show with Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, yeah. You'd be stupid to not... try and get money in a theatrical release?
No, I think it's been an open question. Like, some people have been questioning whether Netflix was going to do that indefinitely.
Yeah.
Because that's not their model.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to show their movies in theaters. They want you to watch it on Netflix.
Yeah.
Right? So I think, to your point, I think a large reason why they are still willing to do that is because they want the money to offset some of the cost that they're going to be spending,
mm-hmm.
probably about $60 billion. But then I think if we look beyond that, I think there's no reason to think that I think it'll work out very spectacularly for Netflix, almost at any price that they pay.
Mm-hmm. So that was what John Malone
yes.
said. John Malone, of course, is the founder of Liberty Media that has owned a number of cable networks.
Yeah.
I mean, just a famous investor in TV who never bought Netflix in his Liberty Media, but
yes.
owns the shares personally. He said that there's no price too high that Netflix can pay for this, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
he said it'll be a home run at almost any price.
Okay.
And so the reason for that
yeah.
is because, number one, all of the existing subscribers that HBO has, HBO Max has,
mm-hmm.
Are now going to, all the revenue that they're earning is basically pricing power that you add to Netflix.
Yeah.
Because I think HBO Max today has about roughly 60 million subscribers, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of those are Netflix subscribers.
Yeah.
And the problem for HBO Max is that they only take a certain percentage of the revenue that they're charging for HBO Max, because they share a lot of that with the distributors like Comcast. To the extent that they're able to now, Netflix is able to transition those subscribers to Netflix,
mm-hmm.
they can just raise the price on these subscribers. The subscribers would be happier because they're probably going to be paying a less price
mm-hmm.
combined. They only have to navigate to one streaming service
yeah.
with a better viewing experience, because Crave, as you know, is not very good in
yeah.
Canada. And the cherry on top is that it handicaps their competitors as well,
mm-hmm.
because HBO Max relies heavily on bundling with other companies like Disney Plus
mm-hmm.
to drive sales.
Mm-hmm.
And so... There's all these different levers for Netflix to be able to capture value from adding mm-hmm. this type of content to their service.
And just spitballing here, if Netflix wins a day and decides to acquire, what is the potential for it to go for? How many billions of dollars?
I think people are saying $60 billion.
$60 billion. Yeah. Netflix has a market cap of
$450 billion. Yeah.
Okay, so Netflix has about $8 billion of cash on its balance sheet.
Yeah.
Net.
But they would be issuing equity.
They would be issuing
sure.
mostly, probably all equity.
Yeah,
so that will cause dilution. But
yeah.
on the same time, you'll have a significant increase in profits, hopefully, in free cash flow, and the ability for Netflix to start buying back those shares over time.
And then I think the last thing is that even to the extent that Netflix is not successful in getting Warner, by driving the price higher, they are saddling their competitors with equity dilution or debt, right? Which is kind of the whole problem that Warner is in today, where they have too much debt and are not able to compete.
In my dream world, Netflix is either going to get the asset now or going to get those assets in the future. I can't see how Paramount or Comcast that have these melting ice cubes of the cable businesses, and we know that's going away at some point, how they won't want to eventually license all this IP to Netflix anyways. So just to finish off and to finish off with this podcast, regulatory. That's the most important. We're in a regulatory environment where to some people's surprise, Google's antitrust case, the remedies were very minimal. Many are talking about how more deals maybe could get through in this under the current administration or not. How likely is this to happen, Netflix? Because I can see the theaters being unhappy. I can see the cable companies obviously being very unhappy about this. I can see people saying, well, Netflix is just going to raise the price to like $40 a month or whatever. And, consumers will be unhappy. Bottom line is, are we in an environment where regulatory would approve this deal, in your opinion?
So I think it's been it's no secret that that Trump prefers that Paramount would be the winner.
Okay.
I think he is, he has a good relationship with the Ellisons, and he doesn't want. He would certainly like CNN to be owned by a more politically favorable entity to himself personally, right? So I think Paramount.
And that could still happen, right? Netflix is only looking to carve out the streaming and theatrical business.
So it has, I think the general consensus is that it'll be a more challenging path for Netflix and Comcast to complete the deal on an antitrust perspective. I think what Netflix is saying is that their primary competition is not the legacy media world. It's a broader context of media overall, which includes companies like YouTube, like Instagram, TikTok.
Yeah, and big loaded competitors, Apple and Amazon, Google, right? You can't say that Netflix is a monopoly business. There's a lot of attention for your eyeballs. Right.
And I think that, I'm sure that if Netflix ends up being the successful bidder, there will be a long, drawn-out process specifying conditions that they have to continue licensing content to third-party suppliers and all that stuff.
This might not close until mid-2027.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't think... I think it'll ultimately probably go through. Like, I don't think Netflix will try and do it if they didn't think there was a chance that it would happen.
Yeah. Very good. So I think we'll end it there. It was a great discussion about Copart and Netflix, as well as Couche-Tard. Remember about our webinar we'll be having on December 11th at 7 p.m. We'll be sending out very shortly on socials how you can sign up for that. It's free, no cost. Just listen. If you have any questions, we'd love to take them. And we'll hopefully have a really good time. Next week, we'll be back. We'll talk about Canadian banks and also touch on the Canadian telcos. We sold all our telcos a number of years ago. We were really worried about the sustainability of the dividends. And, given the free cash flows that these companies are generating, we feel they're in big trouble and really need to focus on cutting their dividends like Bell Canada did. So we'll get into all that and more. See you real soon. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.